Good evening. This is Bill O'Brien. I'm here with Keith Lilly, and we're here for, is this our fourth chat? Our fourth chat, and it's the last one in this PRISM West Virginia class, the first course. We're going to end our semester for those teachers out there who are in the PRISM West Virginia program. Everything must be ended by Friday the 13th. I didn't plan that way, but grades have to be turned in by Saturday the 14th. So I plan to turn grades in for everybody on Friday the 13th. And so all of your essays for units 1, 2, and 3 have to be to me by the 13th. By the 10th, with the Tuesday. And then I'll get them all graded, and I'll be getting your grades posted by Friday the 13th. So this is our last chat, Keith, everybody uses the expression that this is a work in progress, but in reality, these chats have indeed been that, because we had no idea when we first started that we were going to do this. But the more it became clear to me that students enrolled in this course would be kind of in free fall out there with no contact with us other than when an assignment was due or whatever, it seemed like we had to be able to find a way to connect. And thanks to Bob Kincaid and the Head On Radio Network, we've been able to do that. We've been able to do that in a somewhat painless way for our teachers, I think. And the fact that we have so many folks out there who are not involved directly in the PRISM program, but have been looking and involving themselves and participating in our chat sessions, it's a joy. And it's something that once it took off and once we began to see the potential of this, we just decided that we would expand it and expand it. So beginning in the fall, we're going to be doing this course again, but we'll also be doing a course in 19th century America, within which an event happens called, depending on what part of the country you live in, the Civil War, the War Between the States, or
War of Northern Aggression,
or War over accents, or whatever you want to call it. But so we'll be doing two online courses simultaneously beginning in September of 2011. And what Keith and I have decided to do is that we will manage the two courses in such a way that we will use these chats as kind of bridges between one course and another. And we will make, for those who are enrolled for credit, which will be our teachers, and we will at that time have more than 60 teachers enrolled, we will make sure that these courses do not become counterproductive in that one works against the other. We are aware that the people who are enrolled in the classes for credit are taking two courses at the same time, and we'll schedule our exams and our chats and everything else with that in mind, so that we'll make sure that this becomes an asset rather than a liability and a detriment to the success of the course. So with that in mind, let me just repeat one more time, and then we'll get rid of all the housework at the front end. All essays need to be submitted by Tuesday, May 10th. For those of you who still owe me essays on Units 1 and Unit 2, please keep that in mind, that after the 10th of May, which is a Tuesday, I'm going to be concentrating on getting everything graded so that I can get your grades posted by Friday the 13th. And that'll be in plenty of time before the end of the semester for Concord. Everybody's grade will be up and posted, and everything will be hunky-dory. So, again, if you have any questions, I want you to notice the email address and the phone number behind us. It's Margaret Ramsey, mramsey@concord.edu. If you would like to participate by asking a question or making a comment during tonight's program, you can do so in two ways. One is to call us at area code 304-256-0270, extension 229, and that will get you to Margaret Ramsey. Or you can email Margaret directly at mramsey@concord.edu, and she will print out the question and get it in here to us. We'll get the question on the air, and hopefully we'll try to come up with an answer for it. We'll pretend we do, even if we don't. So again, it's mramsey@concord.edu, or phone number, area code 304-256-0270, extension 229. And Margaret is sitting there with her computer on, and the phone at her left hand, and she is rearing to go. She's just waiting to hear from you. So, with that, anything else that we need to to touch on, or you want to get right into the material, Keith?
Well, I will say one thing. I've placed two new items on the Blackboard page, on the Prism page. One is the papers of Benjamin Franklin from Yale University, which our teachers can access, and they can search those documents. They don't need any to worry about any fees or anything of that nature. And also the War of the Rebellion, official records, the Civil War records. There's a link to both of those document collections on Prism. And so for the future, we will have those there.
Right. And then when next semester, when we begin the second course, we'll have those available on that link as well. So, the Blackboard site grows as we go, so to speak. One of the things that we're going to put it on, and I will make reference later this evening, but last evening on C-SPAN, there was an interview with a historian who has written a book on George Washington called Inventing George Washington. And the fellow's name is George, and I believe it's later, but let me check. Let me check. I wrote his name down. I just want to make sure that should have had this available. Edward Lengel is the author, and the book is entitled Inventing George Washington. And on C-SPAN last night, there was a one-hour interview with Professor can't remember his name, and I just said it. Lengel, I think it is.
Yeah.
Basically, it was a pretty solid interview. I wanted everybody to see it. So after we get through this evening, we'll put that on Blackboard as well. So that if you go on Google and just Google Inventing George Washington, you'll see under afterwards. The interview on with the author of Inventing George Washington. It's pretty solid stuff and pretty good stuff. I plan to get into that a little bit later this evening. So you want to get right into the material,
sure.
Keith?
Sure. Do you want to review Unit 1 and 2, or do you?
Yeah,
want to...
and this is on your Blackboard site. This is the third unit of the third portion of the syllabus for the Pillars of Principle course. And what I tried to do was summarize Unit 1 and Unit 2 around the themes that we've developed as a setup for Unit 3. And I thought if we could lead logically into it, it would make a lot more sense. So the first thing, if you haven't had a chance to look at Blackboard yet and notice this third unit on it, you will note that entire document is six and a half pages, which... it's rather puny compared to parts 1 and 2, but...
Let me interrupt. I'm going to commit you to something, and I haven't talked with you about this, but if any of our listeners who are not taking this course, if they wanted access to these questions or these documents, I'm assuming that if they emailed us, we would provide that.
If you email Margaret Ramsey at that address or call her, we will get you the syllabus for the course.
Okay.
It is available on Blackboard, but in order to access the Blackboard site, you have to have a Concord email address and password. And our teachers have it, but those of you who are not enrolled in the course do not. So what I would suggest is that you contact Margaret Ramsey in the address that's up behind us, either by phone or by email, and we will make sure that you have a copy of the entire syllabus for the course. I will just send you back an email with the syllabus as an attachment. And you can have it if you'd like it. I'd really for me it's been a labor of love. It's something that I wanted to do my whole career, and as those of you who have looked at it already can tell by the length of the syllabus, it became an opportunity for me to talk about historiography, to talk about the significance in today's political world of the issues we're dealing with, the founders and the values of the founders and all the rest of it. I've always believed that this stuff is so relevant to what we're seeing in today's world. And I think more of that's going to be evident this evening,
right,
as much as anything. I think this particular unit is incredibly loaded with stuff.
And in case, especially our original teachers are not familiar with this, our rotundo is up. And so we do have that.
Right.
Off the library site, off Concord's library site, the databases.
Yeah.
And so those of our teachers who have that Concord email address and password, they can access.
You can directly access Rotunda, which is all the papers of the founders. One of the people who's not there is Benjamin Franklin, but Keith has put access to Benjamin Franklin's papers, which are available free through Yale University, on our Blackboard site as well.
And you can search them. You can search him by day.
See, they're just great. Yeah. And he's been all over the Franklin papers since he found out that Yale had made them available free of charge. So it's just fantastic. And Franklin's speeches and letters, and it's just wonderful stuff. So if we can, let's get directly into this. And I thought the most logical way for me to do it, as I was trying to put the last portion of the syllabus together for the class, is to kind of review units 1 and unit 2 with the idea that if I was able to do it successfully, it would lead logically into unit 3. Or to put it the other way, that unit 3 would flow logically from where we were in units 1 and units 2. So if some of this is summary, to some of you who have seen this, fine. But for those who are tuned in and have not had a chance to, do not have access to Blackboard, this is going to be a review as much as anything else. So I want to basically acknowledge the fact that there are a lot of people who are witnessing and participating in this evening's chat who are not enrolled in the PRISM program and who are taking the opportunity to tune in and hopefully pick up some of this information. Hopefully we're going to make it worthwhile for you. So with those folks in mind more than anything else, let's kind of summarize where we've been in order before we begin to suggest for this evening where we're going.
Yeah.
In Unit 1, if you recall, we focused principally on the ideals and the values and the principles of the founders. What it was they were trying to accomplish, what the major issue around independence seemed to be. If you remember from our reading, there was an awful lot of discussion and debate in the congresses and in the private correspondence at the time over the issue of independence. In spite of the fact that our textbooks try to make independence almost an American consensus, that everybody within all 13 colonies really supported the movement for independence, the fact of the matter is it was quite different than that. The very famous letter of John Adams, in which he said that one-third of the American population were patriots, one-third were loyal to the mother country, and one-third were kind of neutral. They were in the middle, and they really didn't know which way to go. And John Adams's argument was that politically, those who sided with him in support of independence had to win that moderate group in the middle over to their side. And if you remember the politics of the First and Second Continental Congresses, they were able to do that. The Adamses, along with Richard Henry Lee and some of the Virginians and Patrick Henry and all the rest of it, they were able to swing the vote for independence, which ultimately led to the drafting of the Declaration. But if you remember, in Unit 1, we talked about the fact that what we were looking at was the ideals and the values and the principles, what it was that the founders really wanted independence to produce, how they could create the kind of society that they really thought was possible, as well as a recognition of some of the obstacles that they would have to overcome in order to successfully do that. And so if you remember, there was an awful lot of opposition to that from those we referred to in previous chats as conservatives, the Dickinsons and the James Wilsons and the more conservative, articulate, constitutional scholars, if you were legal scholars, among the founders who really saw the pros and cons and the intricacies of independence and realized that there was a lot more to a Declaration of Independence than seemed to be on the surface. Not only for them, I mean, they would be enemies. If the British caught them, they would be hanged for treason, and they knew that. But it was not only that. Many of the founders believed that the kind of society that existed in America at the time, the kind of society that these people supported and wanted to continue after independence, would be in jeopardy with independence. Brief. Conservative people in the Congresses believed, the Dickinsons and the Wilsons and the others, believed that man's nature was basically evil. that man would not do what he should do unless he was forced to do what was right. And so ultimately what these people believed is that the potential for chaos and anarchy that existed in any society was kept under control by the strong super control of the mother country. In other words, it was the threat of British troops and the idea of the mother country and the laws of the mother country that kept the lid on in colonial America, that maintained a stable society. And these people believed that once you set a precedent of declaring independence and overthrowing government that you argued was not legitimate, you were setting a precedent. You were unleashing a force that you couldn't control after that. So there were many people that were opposed to independence. And this becomes the political give and take that took place in the Continental Congresses and ultimately is resolved with the successful approval of the Declaration of Independence.
And at the same time, we looked at this from the British point of view as well.
Yes.
And especially with your question about Lord North.
You're right.
And in which,
you're a member of Lord North.
Assume the position
and
of
Lord
basically
North. The argument is that I think most scholars would agree that if the British had really done their homework and they had been much more aware of the fact that there was substantial opposition to independence within America, England ignored that. England basically painted everybody who was taking positions against the mother country into a corner and left moderates with no option but either to surrender to the total power of the mother country in Parliament or to stand up as men, so to speak, against the mother country. And so, in reality, many scholars believed that Britain played right into the hands of the radicals during this period.
The reaction to the Boston Tea Party as essentially being an overreaction.
Right, right.
Whereas they could have exploited the situation and the differences between the colonies.
And the possibility to divide and conquer within the colonies. The fact that the one thing that that many scholars point out is that the Adamses, especially the Adamses, were able to form alliances with prominent Virginians like Richard Henry Lee and Patrick Henry, and were able to unite New England and the South. And if Great Britain had played its cards right and never allowed that union of southern, middle, and northern colonies to happen, they could have played the divide and conquer game and really probably handled the situation if they had been wiser. But be that as it may, what we talked about was the idea of republican government that the founders settled upon. In other words, their argument was that what you had to have, what you had with independence, was an opportunity that mankind rarely ever in the history of man ever had, which is the ability of people to set up their own government, to create their own form of government which would accomplish the kinds of goals which would create the kind of standard of living that the founders, the optimists among the founders really believed would be possible. And so they called it republicanism. And basically, while, as we, I think we all agreed, and the literature reinforced the fact, that republicanism is a little bit difficult to define. But basically, it involved things like political openness and participation of more and more people and the idea of accountability of government, that people had the right to hold their elected officials accountable for what they did in office. The recognition, what the Declaration of Independence refers to, is man's unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The idea that there were basic human rights that governments were created to protect. The idea that in order for popular participatory government to really work, for republicanism to really work, you had to have a sense of civic virtue. You had to have this idea that people were willing to put their own private self-interest aside, and to basically put the public interest ahead of that. The willingness to put the best interest of the community as a whole ahead of their own personal, private self-interests. And the founders believed that if you set up a government based on those principles, you could turn independence into the war for independence into a positive thing, which produced the kind of ideal government that the founders really believed that man ought to have and could have. And so ultimately, the Declaration of Independence, the philosophy behind it, was very, very positive. It was very, very optimistic. And it basically set a goal for the founders, which they believed was achievable, but would be very, very difficult to achieve, but was possible. And as we transition from Unit 1 of this course into Unit 2, when we began to look at the Declaration of Independence itself, and we began to look at the constitutions that were being created with the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress recommended that the states draw up declarations of independence and begin to write constitutions, because now they were independent, free republics, modeled on the republican form of government, the theory of which was outlined in the Declaration and in the local decorations. And if you remember the books by the American Scripture by Pauline Meyer, which is on the Declaration of Independence, she points out that in area after area throughout the colonies, local towns and counties and communities began to write their own declarations of independence. So in reality, what Pauline Meyer points out is you get a better look at what the people actually believed independence was about than you do by looking at the Declaration of Independence. And she points out that in her book American Scripture that you have Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration, and then you have the draft with the political changes that were necessary to get it through. And so in reality, you learn much more about what Jefferson believed from his original draft than you do from the appended or amended draft that finally becomes the Declaration of Independence. So she points out a couple of things which I think are very, very significant in her American Scripture book. One is that what the people really thought independence was about was probably much more evident in the declarations of independence that they wrote and approved for themselves than it was in the declaration that Jefferson was able to get through the Congress, especially since in order to get it through, he had to make all sorts of political compromises with things that he believed. So better to read Jefferson's original draft rather than the final draft, and then you begin to get a clear idea as to what Jefferson believed independence was all about and what independence would possibly lead to. And then we get into the second unit of the course, and what we find is that it's not very far into the 1780s before the founders become confronted with a contradiction of all time. And that is that it's a heck of a lot easier to put on paper a vision of what a republican form of government ought to be and the way you ought to set it up. It's a lot harder to actually set up a system that actually works. In other words, it's one thing to sketch a car. It's another thing to get it to run. And so in reality, what we find between Unit 1 and Unit 2 here is a statement of the ideals and the values and principles of the founders as they envisioned them to be after independence. And then you begin to look at what the founders actually found out they had to do in order to make this work. And very, very quickly, the founders begin to realize that they had been way too optimistic in 1776 about public virtue and about people's willingness to put their own self-interest aside in the interest of the public, in favor of the public interest. And that in reality, it was going to become necessary to create an environment which created things that the founders probably thought were already there. You know, the civic virtue and the patriotism and the commitment to the public interest and all these kinds of things. So what we have in Unit 2 is a look at the constitutions that are drawn up on the state level, the most democratic one being the Constitution of Pennsylvania, which creates a one-house legislature where most of the power is put into the hands of the representatives of the people. The governor's power is almost insignificant. The governor is made dependent on the legislature. There is no Senate. There is no upper house. There is no separate judiciary. In reality, judicial decisions are made through committees of the legislature. So in reality, you have a form of government set up under the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, which is just about the most democratic constitution ever created, ever written in America. It puts power as close to the people as it's ever been before. very, very quickly, the founders begin to realize that their optimism in the virtue and in the willingness of the American people to put aside private interest and to replace it with public interest was misplaced. And very, very quickly, we begin to get a movement towards what becomes a movement towards nationalism, a movement first to strengthen the Articles of Confederation in such a way that the national government had more power rather than just be a league of friendship among free and independent states, Republican forms of government, Republicans, republics as it were, 13 republics. And not too far into the 1780s, the so-called nationalists, led by people like Madison and Hamilton and the others, began to lobby in their private letters back and forth for something that involves much more than merely revising the Articles of Confederation. They decide that the only way to save the nation is to scrap the Articles of Confederation and replace it with a new government which has the power and the ability to enforce the law and to force people to do things that the founders had optimistically believed people would do of their own accord. And what we have then is the calling of the Philadelphia Convention, the drafting of the Constitution, the compromises that make up so much of the Constitutional Convention. And one of the things that I tried to suggest in the second unit syllabus here is, and I still think it's very important, everybody seems to focus on the compromises that were reached during the Constitutional Convention. But the fact of the matter is, if you think about compromise, in order to reach compromise, there's got to be something bigger than what it is each side is willing to give up. In other words, if I'm able to reach, to negotiate with you, to negotiate away my differences with you and your differences with me, then there has got to be something bigger that keep us in a compromising mood. Because if the compromises become too drastic, too big, then one would expect the convention itself to just break up because it was no longer possible to reach compromise. The fact that the founders, and again, but we're talking about some of the same founders, but some of the different founders as well.
Very different composition.
Very different composition of founders in the Constitutional Convention. But one of the things we begin to realize is the very fact that they are able to reach compromise on such things as slavery, abolishing the slave trade in 20 years. In other words, they make a recommendation that the slave trade will not be abolished for 20 years after the new government goes into effect. They make an agreement to hold North and South together, which is the very famous Three-Fifths Compromise, that for purposes of representation and taxation, two-thirds of the slaves will count, or three-fifths. Or to be crass about it, that each slave will count as three-fifths of a person.
Without using the word slave.
Without using the
slave. Or the word slavery
other,
in the Constitution.
Other persons.
Persons held to service or labor.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, basically, what we're talking about here is the ability to make some very, very serious, heady compromises. And my feeling is that what we can never forget is there had to be something bigger, something that they would lose if they ever reached the point where compromise no longer became possible. There was one point during the convention, you'll recall, if you read Beeman's book, where they adjourn and they decide to, almost on a cooling off period in July of 1787, they basically adjourn the convention ostensibly to give the committee on detail time to put down in writing the decisions and the compromises that they've already reached. In other words, what they do is they create a committee on detail and they ask this committee to sit and put down on paper a draft of what they've already agreed to. And that, so they take a week off, about 10 days off. But in reality, as Beeman points out, they had reached the point where they were, the convention was going to split. There was, if they hadn't taken a break when they did, it was almost like in the basketball, the hockey game the other night I was watching in the Stanley Cup playoffs. When Montreal was playing the Boston Bruins, I happen to be a fan there. But Boston was ahead 3-0, and Montreal got one goal. Then they got two goals. Then they tied it up with a third goal. Then they went ahead 4-3. And in hockey, you get one timeout. And the coach used that timeout to kind of settle the team down. And after that brief timeout, it was only 20 seconds, but after he called everybody together at the bench, they went out there and they kind of had recovered their poise and were able to handle it. And it turned out they tied the game, went into overtime and won it in overtime. The point I was trying to make is many of the commentators, ESPN people, were saying that this was one of the times when a timeout was so appropriate. You know, it worked so well. It accomplished exactly what the purpose of a timeout is to kind of, you know, get your bearings together and get everything together and get yourself back on track and all that. And that's exactly what happened. Well, that's what the convention does in the middle of the summer in 1787. They have reached the point where it looks like they're going to split. Because every time they reached, and most of the time the differences were sectional, were differences between North and South based either directly on slavery or indirectly on slavery. What I mean by that is how much slaves were going to count in representation, how many congressmen each southern state was going to have, whether slaves were going to count as whole people or only three-fifths of a person or whatever. And finally, when they reached the point where it looked like compromise was no longer possible and the convention was just going to disband and that was the end of it, they decided to take a holiday, a 10-day break. And at that point, they asked the Committee on Detail to put together what they already had, give everybody a chance to cool off and catch their breath, and then come back and start again. And it worked. It really worked. So what they do is they come back, and they are able to get the Constitution through the convention with Franklin's very, very famous statement at the end about put aside your differences and, as much as possible, pretend or try to imagine that this is the best darn Constitution that we could ever have and go back and sell it that way. In other words, if we force these people to come back together, they're not going to be able to get anything better. Chances are they'll end up with something a lot worse. So, in other words, what Franklin says is the very best that thinking people could agree on, we got. Let's pass it. We'll fix it later if it doesn't work, if we need to amend it. And then we had the ratification struggle and the story in each state as to what's necessary in order to get the Constitution through. And, of course, one of the major issues, two major issues of the ratification struggle, the first one is the absence of a Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And Madison finally is forced to become an advocate for a Bill of Rights and is forced to commit himself to making the first order of business in the new Congress, in the first Congress, the passing of amendments to the Constitution, the protection of individual rights. He commits to that. And the second thing is to try to head off the strategy of the Anti-Federalists to get a second convention. Because Franklin pointed out in his last speech, and they know that if we ever get back in convention again, everything we've accomplished during the summer of 1787 will be lost. We went as far as we could go. We got the best we could get. What we got to do is get it through with the idea that we can amend it. There's an amendment procedure in there. If it doesn't work, we can fix it later. And so that becomes the background, Units 1 and Unit 2. And so what we have then is what the founders originally believed they could do. And then we find out in the 1780s, by the time we get through the Constitution and ratification of the Constitution, we begin to look at the changes in republicanism, what the founders realized they had to do in order to make republican government work in this post-independence American society. And that's where we kind of launch into the third unit of the course, which we're about ready to get into now.
So Unit 3 essentially is dealing with this government implementation.
With the implementation, what we're looking
and
at.
How effective it was.
Right.
And what we
want to keep in mind, and this is the theme, and it seems to me that if the course hangs together, if one unit seems to flow naturally into the next unit, and those two into the third unit, then it seems natural to me that what we look at with the administration of Washington and John Adams, and then the election of Jefferson in 1800, and, of course, we have 8 years of Jefferson, and then we have Madison's administration, and then we get to the end of the War of 1812. And that's kind of where this course ends. And the book that I've asked you, and it is on your Kindle, is Gordon Wood's Empire of Liberty, which was just published this past year in 2010. It's an absolutely superb book. It's a monumental study.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making is each, and we'll get into this in some detail in a minute, the chapters are incredible. The information in here is incredible. Again, this is not a course where you're going to have to take multiple choice tests and pass and master all the information in here. What you want to do as teachers, and I'm talking now to our enrolled teachers, is to look for the questions that take you where you and your students need to go in terms of the standards that you're going to have to meet in order to successfully keep your job as a teacher and to help your students master the material that they have to master on tests that they have to take.
And I'll point out that this is a wonderful reference work.
Oh, this is...
I mean, you can use it as a reference because it's not just about politics. It's also about culture and art and religion and all different aspects of
America's society. It's the most monumental study of this period, this so-called early national period, which is the period that begins with the establishment of the new government under Washington and takes us through the Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison administrations. So it basically covers the period 1789, which is the inauguration of Washington, up to 1815, which is the Treaty of Ghent and the conclusion of the War of 1812. And it's during that period. And what I'm asking you to look for is the next logical extension of Units 1 and Units 2. In Unit 1, we saw what the founders envisioned the principles of republican government, of popular government to be, what they thought that independence would produce in America. Then we looked at, in the 1780s, the compromises that they had to make out of reality in order to get this thing to work at all. The biggest compromise is obviously the movement towards the Constitution itself and the scrapping of the Articles. So in reality, I make this suggestion in the syllabus here, but it seems to me in reality that we could say that the Articles of Confederation were really the first Constitution of the United States. Because the Articles of Confederation reflected what the founders believed independence ought to make possible. In other words, the Articles of Confederation was a form of government that was perfectly consistent with the optimism of the founders. A government where people were willing to put aside their own self-interest in behalf of the public interest. A government in which people rightly believed that they had a right to hold their elected officials accountable for what they did as representatives. In other words, government had to be accountable to the people that created it. Sovereignty remained with the people. The people were the ultimate source of power. And the people never relinquished their total power. The people created government, Jefferson says in the Declaration, which received its legitimate right to govern from the people. But the people were the ultimate source of power, said John Locke. The people created government, and the people always retained the right to if government was not doing the will of the people, then the people retained the right to abolish that government and to create a government which would function or govern consistent with the will of the people. And that's ultimately the way they justified independence. And I would suggest to you then that in light of that very optimistic philosophy of what the founders really expected independence to produce, the Articles of Confederation was the real Constitution of the United States in reality.
Yeah, because it occurs to me that the Constitution does not give you that right.
The right
to overthrow the existing government. It's treason.
There are definitions of treason in that Constitution.
Right.
In other words, the Constitution of 1787, the U.S. Constitution as we know it, is the ultimate manifestation of the need of the founders to compromise between the optimism that they went into independence with and the realities of the 1780s. In other words, the Constitution of 1787 up against the Articles, it seems to me what you tend to see here is the optimism that was reflected in the Articles of Confederation and the realism that is reflected in the Constitution of the United States. In other words, it was one thing to put down on paper what republican government ought to be able to do what it ought to be about. And the Articles of Confederation reflected that. Republics, they believed from the philosophers that they read, they believed that republics had to be small, and so each state was its own independent republic. But they also believed that in order to conduct foreign policy and for self-protection and everything else, that you need to have some sort of union of these independent republics, of these independent states. So the Confederation was really a league of friendship between independent states, sort of like the United Nations today. You know, the model of the, you know, many people today believe that the United Nations should be abolished because it's ineffective, etc. The United Nations is a model. It's made up of independent nations who sit together as a United Nations in order to address the problems that affect them all. And that's exactly what the founders believe the Articles of Confederation ought to do for the 13 independent states that come out of the
world. So therefore, it's really telling that if you look at, for example, the Franco-American Alliance of 1778 that Franklin and his colleagues negotiated with Louis XVI's regime in France, that the treaty basically is not between the United States and the King of France. It's between the King of France and the individual
states. Each
of
the 13 states.
They're named.
Right.
They're named.
And so,
I believe that's true with the Treaty of Paris of 1783 as well.
And so basically what the Confederation government is more than anything else is the agent of the 13 states. The assumption being that the 13 states will always be able to reach consensus. That's why if you look at the operative, you look at the Confederation Congress, they require that for anything substantial, you had to have unanimous support of all 13 states. And the assumption was that 13 state governments functioning in tandem had to reach consensus. They had to be agreed. And so the Confederation government was merely the agent of the 13 independent republics.
I think we have a question. All right. How were free persons of color to be counted, 3/5 or 1, is the question. And this question is from Jim Anderson.
Okay.
And so how were free persons of color to be counted, 3/5 or 1? I'm under the impression they would be counted as one.
As one.
As one.
As one.
Yeah.
And I think that was the whole idea of the recognition of the institution. It was the institution of slavery that produced the 3/5.
Yeah.
It was not the color of the individual
right.
slave. And so there were blacks who became, you know, who became free through the indentured servant system and all the rest of it. And theoretically, they would be. It's not until much later that states adopt regulations that prevent.
Called the white bases
right.
and things of that nature,
right.
yes.
Exactly. And prevent women from voting. Originally, women, in many states, women could vote as well.
But that's an excellent question. There were some states before the Jacksonian era.
Right.
In which free blacks could vote.
Right.
And especially in New England
right.
states.
Right.
Technically, believe it or not, in North
right.
Carolina.
Right.
It was on the books. But,
and it's not until sectionalism becomes
right.
such a wrenching issue that these rights disappear and the system begins to split apart.
But that's a good question.
It's a great
Mr.
question. And the fact that it focuses on slavery indirectly is important, because ultimately the greatest source of the greatest need for compromise at all was around one way or another around the issue of the institution of slavery, one way or the other, as an economic force, as a social force, as a racial force, all of it. It seemed to me.
So as you lay out Unit 2. You see a great difference between the idealism of the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation and the realism of
right.
the Constitutional Convention,
right.
the realism of someone like Hamilton
right.
especially. As we get into Unit 3, there were a lot of realities.
But there's a caution here.
That they would have to deal with, too.
And there's a caution here. There's,
okay.
There's a but.
Okay.
And the but is that there were many people who wanted to replace the Articles with the Constitution, who wanted to get rid of the Articles for what would... So far, we've talked about the fact that these would be public interest issues. In other words, that the optimism of the founders was misplaced, And so therefore you had to have a government which had much more power and the ability to enforce its will and the ability to tax and all the rest of it. Fact of the matter is, the real story of ratification is a lot more involved than that, and the real story of the constitution of the drafting of the Constitution. And this is thesis, this is interpretation. But I'm stating it this way because I happen to support this particular interpretation. But I admit that it is interpretation only. I believe that the real story behind the Constitution and the scrapping of the Articles revolves around is not so much the issue of whether power is located on the national level or the state level, the locus of power, which seems to be the debate. But my feeling is the real debate is over which people exercise that power, and where it is determines who has it. To be very, very honest, I believe that the real issue around the Constitution of the United States is the fact that the nationalists, the people pushing hardest for the scrapping of the Articles of Confederation, believed that the reason you had to take power out of the hands of the state governments and put it in the hands of a national government was because when power was in the hands of the state governments, it was too susceptible to rule by majority. It was too susceptible to democratic.
Pennsylvania would be the worst case scenario.
Pennsylvania was the classic example. And at the time of the convention, Rhode Island was a classic example. It didn't even send delegates to Philadelphia. And basically, the reality is the opening of the convention, when Governor Randolph welcomed the delegates at Philadelphia in late May of 1787, his opening address to the delegates in Philadelphia, and I'm paraphrasing here, said, "There are a lot of different reasons we're here. We've had positive experiences and negative experiences." And he makes reference to Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts. He makes reference to the fact that we have reached a situation where citizens are taking up arms against their own governments, and governments do not have the power to put down these rebellions. And then Randolph says, "The bottom line is the reason we are here is because there's too much democracy in this country. There are too many examples of power falling into the hands of the wrong people." So in a sense, my feeling is that the real story here is by moving power from the state level to the national level, you are moving it from access to those that Hamilton referred to as the many, and you are guaranteeing that decisions will be made only by the few. And that's the real story. And for those of you who've read Woody Holton's book on unruly Americans, basically that's the thesis that he subscribes to as well, that the real story about where you put power is not the real story, but the reality is where power is determines who has it. And so it becomes much more difficult for the majority of the people, who happen to be the poor. It becomes much more difficult for majorities to rule when power is on the national level, because as Madison said in Federalist Number 10, that means the majority faction has to be the majority of the whole population of the country, and there's no way in the world to organize that majority. Until now, with technology, we see that the Tea Parties are able to do it. But, and that's another story for another day. But Madison believed that by putting power in a place where majorities could not gain access to it, then you ensured that decisions would be made by the minority. Because the reality is, this is just common sense if you think about it, and sometimes people don't like to, but somebody's making decisions. Somebody is deciding what should and should not happen. And the fact of the matter is, if the majority is not making those decisions, then the minority is. Somebody's making them.
So this is how you would explain such things as the Electoral College, electing senators by state legislatures.
In other words, every mechanism possible is used by the convention to keep power out of the direct hands of the people. the only power, the only branch of government where the people have direct access is one half of the legislative branch, the House of Representatives. And even then, with things like property qualifications and all the rest of it, by, as Madison says in Federalist No. 10, by enlarging the sphere, creating large electoral districts, congressional districts, you guarantee that only the best-known people are going to stand a chance to get elected to the Congress. So even in the people's branch, which is the House of Representatives, you're going to have the most prominent citizens representing the people. And then you have the Senate, and you know, which is made up, obviously, chosen by state legislatures. And then you have the court, which is appointed by the president with the approval of the Senate.
Right.
And so ultimately, and then you have the president elected by the Electoral College. So in reality, you only have one half of one of the three branches where the people have direct access to power. Every other place, it's indirect. And they have to rely on other people to speak for the best interests of the people. But the people never get the opportunity to define their own self-interest.
So near the end of this period that we're thinking about in terms of the whole course, when you're starting to increase the size of the electorate, move away from property qualifications,
right,
go to direct election of electors, that is in essence why you feel, and we talked about this the last chat, you used the Emerson quote, the idea that the framers were not happy, they were not pleased with
because
what they saw as they were leaving the
because
Senate.
Because it would seem to me that the founders of 1776 would look at Washington and Jefferson, and look at what happened to republicanism as they envisioned it in 1776. By 1815, they would look at it and say that there had been so many compromises made in their vision of what republican government ought to be that it was barely recognizable anymore from what they envisioned in 1776.
Like Andrew Jackson.
That would be my
and the type of politics that he
represented. Exactly, and that's what Gordon Wood says, and I think I put that in the syllabus here as well. The American hero in 1776 and after was George Washington. But by the time you get into the early 19th century, the American hero is Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson was hardly the kind of American that the Madisons and the Jeffersons and the Washingtons would have wanted to be the typical American.
Right.
You know, I mean, hardly. Andrew Jackson participated in duels. He was in so many ways. He typified all the values that are preached during this period. But what we're talking about, by the time we get to the third unit of this course, we're talking about an approach to Republican government that had changed substantially from what it was before.
So in Unit 2, the realities of independence, in essence, helped to bring about the Constitution.
Right.
But here in Unit 3, I assume that we're dealing with the realities that this new government has to confront.
So in other words, what we're looking at is what the new government, what kinds of questions the new government confronted and how they chose to deal with them, and the extent to which we were looking at the ideas of the original founders or whether we were looking at accommodations made to the original ideas of the founders. In other words, what we're examining is the government that is being set up under the Constitution in 1789 by looking at the Washington administration and then John Adams, and then especially Jefferson's administration, because Jefferson argued when he called his own election a revolution, the revolution of 1800. And the question that seems to me has confronted historians ever since is the extent to which Jefferson's election really was a revolution. Because Jefferson came into office in his inaugural and said, we're all Republicans, we're all Democrats, and basically he began to emphasize the need of the groups to come together and to find common ground, compromise. And that becomes the model of America's two-party system ever since. And what we find is that it's always possible to find middle ground between the extremes of the two sides, whether they're Jeffersonians and Federalists, whether they're Jacksonians and Republicans, it doesn't matter what they are. There always seem to be two positions, Whigs and Jacksonians or whatever. But they find common ground and they're able to come together. When they are unable to come together, you have something called the Civil War. In other words, when the differences between the two groups get to the point where compromise is no longer possible, then our system, our fabric of government is is torn asunder as
But I can understand why historians would see the election of 1800 as revolutionary. In a sense, if you look at other revolutions, especially the French Revolution, when one faction comes to power,
it's the first time
they kill everyone in the other faction.
It's the first time that, where you had a peaceful transition from one group, from the out-group to the in-group, you know, where the out-group becomes the in-group without beheadings and everything else that, that went along with them. So in that sense, it's a revolution. Mm-hmm. But in the sense of change, both before 1800 and after 1800, there's a big debate as to how much change. I think there's significant change. And I would argue that that change becomes merely the examples of the kinds of compromises with republicanism as the founders originally conceived it that were necessary in order to make this work. And in the process, you come up with a whole different kind of government, a whole different approach to what American society is about, what the typical American is, and all the rest of it. And I think that's really what we're into is in Unit 3. Whether we're under the Washington administration and under Jefferson, Congress and the leaders of the of each party, we can call them parties at this time, the different groups in Congress are debating the philosophies that divide them and are trying to find ways to compromise. And in the process, they are laying down the foundations for what becomes a Republican form of government that, takes off in the 19th century.
I've always found it so ironic and fascinating that, in essence, the parties really come out, and factions or parties, how you want to put them, they're not formal parties. I know you really don't have that until later with Jackson, but those two factions basically come out of Washington's cabinet.
Yeah,
I mean they're there,
and
it's going to be disagreements over certain policies.
And, they're epitomized in the persons of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I think it's fabulous stuff. You know, one of the things that the best example of this is in Gordon Wood's book Empire of Liberty. The book begins with the story of Rip Van Winkle. And theoretically, Rip Van Winkle falls asleep before American independence, before 1776. And when he wakes up 20 years later, or, you know, fourscore and 70 years ago later, he doesn't recognize the country. The country has changed so much. And the whole story of Rip Van Winkle is kind of testimony as to what happens from 1776 to 1815 in terms of what the founders believe is independence is going to produce and ultimately what they find out later that it has to produce. And I guess that produces the question that we've had. We probably ought to get into the
question. All right, you want to look at this question.
Itself.
Okay, and this is how we'll kind of jump off into some of these realities, as we might put it, that this new government had to deal with. Now, as always, the assignment... what teachers need to do is focus on what will be best for them in terms of what they can do with their students.
My purpose here was to create as much choice as possible within the confines of the course itself. And what I was trying to do was provide options with the idea that teachers would take the options that best fit their own teaching needs and the needs of your students. In other words, if you teach grades 4 and 5, then you're probably going to take options that are different than people that are teaching American history in grades 10 and 11, for example.
Right.
You know, depending on what your CSOs require, what standardized testing requires your students to know, you want to make sure that you choose the options that give you command of material that will best benefit you and your students down the road. Okay. So with that, let's look at
the introduction here. In 1816, Congress enacted a tax on imported foreign books. Jefferson protested, as did Harvard, Yale, and other elite institutions. The American Philosophical Society and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee defended the tariff as follows. And here we have a quote from the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And he said, and I quote, "Our government is peculiar to ourselves, and our books of instruction should be adapted to the nature of the government and the genius of the people. In the best of foreign books, we are liable to meet with criticism and comparisons not very flattering to the American people. In American editions of these, the offensive and illiberal parts are expunged or explained. and the work is adapted to the exigencies, and tastes of the American reader. But withdraw the protection, our channels of instruction will be foreign. Our youth will imbibe sentiment, form attachments, and acquire habits adverse to our prosperity, unfriendly to our government, and dangerous to our liberties.
I would read that quote, if I were taking this, I would read that quote 5 and 6 times.
Yeah.
Because what this man is saying is that the reason we had to tax books coming into this country from overseas was because one of government's responsibilities is to protect our citizens from points of view on issues that don't conform to what they, as Americans, want them to believe. And in doing so, we're protecting their liberties. What we are doing is censoring the information that our people get. And it is seen by this chairman of the Senate Finance Committee during this period, it is seen as the duty of government to protect the citizens from ideas that do not conform to what Americans ought to believe. Now, I ask you, I mean, and we'll go on, you can read the rest of the thing later, but when I read that quote, and it's quoted in Gordon Book's Empire of Liberty on page 735, is where you'll find that quote. And it's unbelievable to me, because would the founders in 1776, who believed that people were naturally virtuous and who believed that people ought to be free and ought to have choices, that people ought to have a government that they can hold accountable, a government that will protect their rights and their freedoms and their property and all the rest of it, people who went into independence in the most optimistic frame of mind, how would they have, it seems to me they would have rolled over in their graves if they saw a government in 1816, which is 40 years later, that believes that you need to protect American citizens from foreign points of view, which raise questions that they shouldn't even have to answer. So that ultimately the power of government must be used to censor what American people can read and think about. And the assumption is the only way to protect the American way of life is to make sure that nothing foreign or alien ever gets in. And what does that say about education? About the ability of the American people to be educated? The implication here is they can't be, so they need government to protect them. And the founders believe just the opposite. It seems to me that that quote symbolizes exactly where we've come from in this country from 1776 to 1815. That's why I think this is the most incredible period. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Go on and read the rest of the question.
Okay. All right. In his response to this issue, Jefferson's position likely would have been the same in 1776. Had there been an American government with the power to enact such a tax, as it was in 1816. But what clearly had changed was the nation's stance on the same issue. The optimism that had colored the ability of Americans of all stripes to handle information like this was gone. In its place was a tendency to shield our citizens from points of view different from their own, justified by the need to protect American liberties. Now, do you want to look at the individual questions, or do you want to kind of jump off from there?
Okay. Let's read the question, and then we come. I want to make sure that people understand the question, especially the ones that have to answer it.
And again, anyone who is not a part of our program, you can obtain these questions from us.
Sure.
Without any problem.
Oh, exactly.
Your assignment is to select two of the options from the list below and address each as if it were on the same Senate table in 1816, as was the proposed tax on foreign books. And so this is one of those questions that asks you to put yourself into the past, into history, so to speak.
So you have three choices here, and what we're asking you to do is pick two of the three.
Okay.
And just jump in and get up to you and just plod around. And see what happens, because I just think mm-hmm. it's fabulous. Go ahead.
Okay. The first option, how would the founders have handled the matter in 1776, given their attitudes toward America's future, toward people's ability to handle difficult or unfamiliar issues, and toward the plans they had for the nation at the time?
Okay. So the first question, is how would the founders have responded to would have assume that the founders were sitting in the Senate in 1816 when this proposed tax on foreign books came up. Mm-hmm. How would the founders have reacted? You've got all the sources we've looked at, all the material that you've read, et cetera. It seems to me you probably have a fairly good idea.
Yeah, it just occurs to me how many of the framers were readers of Montesquieu and Rousseau.
Right. And they knew how government
yes.
was supposed to work.
Right.
Okay.
The second question, what changes had occurred in the nation and or the world since 1776 that would clearly have altered the founders' response to the issue at hand and perhaps even changed their approach and handling of that issue? To me, that's the... That's the gem. I really like that option.
Yeah.
But the third one is examine each issue you select as it emerged as a key element in America's development during the period, 1789 to 1815. What were the key ingredients raised by the controversy? How did it affect America's future as that future was being defined then? How did that definition differ from what the founders might have sketched out earlier?
Okay. So you're being asked to select two of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And address the questions, and here are I would put these in the area of context,
mm-hmm.
and in other words, what I'm saying, select two items from the list below and apply the questions above to each item. So you ask three questions, and here are your choices. I mean, here are your options for your questions. Select two of them. It doesn't matter where you go. The questions ultimately remain the same. How would the founders have reacted to them? What changes had occurred in the nation since 1776, which clearly would have altered the way the founders dealt with them? And then examine the issues as it emerged as a key element in America's development during the period 1789 to 1815, as the nation actually began to establish the ingredients of the American political system. So here are the issues, and there are five.
Right. Okay, and you're talking about A through E.
A through E.
Okay, A, resolving differences of opinion in America over how best to handle natural differences of opinion between rich and poor in America. B, defining a proper role for government and specific limitations on that role when matters of economic growth and national prosperity were on the table.
Right.
C, achieving a proper respect among other nations of the world for America's rightful role as an equal partner in the world of nations and a respected member of the international community. D, addressing in a way that makes sense to all the proper relationship that should exist in America between rights and powers that are rightfully reserved to the states and those rights and powers which are better carried out on a national level. E, selecting the issue or question from America, selecting the issue or question from America's history during this period, which you believe best makes the case for the transition that had occurred in America between 1776 and 1815, as suggested in the tax issue explained above.
Right.
Okay.
So basically what we're saying is it doesn't matter where you go. The issues are the same. And so what I tried to do was say, here are five major areas. Keith particularly likes item C.
Yes.
I mean, he likes the
yes.
foreign policy issue. There's no question that the founders, and remember John Fiske. John Fiske has a whole chapter in his book, The Critical Period, about how America was being looked down upon and belittled in Europe for the ridiculous form of government where do we deal with one government or do we deal with 13 governments? Or we deal with 14 governments, the 13 individual ones plus the Congress. And so the assumption was that we were taking a beating in the world. And so the question is many of the founders really wanted the United States to be able to stand up and hold its head high and be respected among the world of nations, being respected as an equal. And so the question is, for those people who really believed that how we were perceived in the world and how the rest of the world treated us and how much respect they had for us and all of these things, if that was their priority, then look at that issue according to the three questions. How would the founders have reacted in 76? What kinds of changes had occurred in the nation, et cetera?
And the world.
And the world.
And the world.
What you're trying to do is examine in a number of different issues. For example, the issues between rich and poor. There's no question that how to manage society in such a way that the basic hostility between rich and poor never reached the boiling point is on the minds of the founders. It's on the mind of most governments all the time. So what I'm asking, one of the options is, how did that issue change from 76 to 1815? In other words, what kinds of things happened that altered the way people looked at the relationships between rich and poor in society? It's obvious in 1776 that people believed that there was enough opportunity in the New World that there ought not to be any poor. The assumption is that there was opportunity for everybody here, except slaves who were brought here against their will. But the implications were that this was the really could end poverty. Maybe it really was a nation where people's natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were real. In other words, I would suggest to you that many people who fought for independence, who put their butts on the line and fought for independence, really believed that they were fighting for a way of life that didn't exist, that never existed, where people really would be free, where there would be real opportunity for everybody, where there would be no more poverty in the world, where people really did look out for the other guy, where people really did bring chicken soup to their neighbor when they had the flu. And, you know, I mean, in a sense. In other words, people really believed that this kind of government was possible. And then we saw during the 1780s that it was necessary to make compromises, that what they believed would happen wasn't happening. And gradually they had to make some changes. We also saw the self-interest involved in many of those changes. In other words, whether, and this is Woody Holton's book, whether government responded to the interest of the creditors or whether government responded primarily to the needs of the debtors. In other words, it was clear that in many states, the people believed that government was putting the best interests of the wealthy ahead of the interests of the people. And the result was that in order to pay off debts and pay off these securities that many people were speculating in and getting rich on, government was taxing the people and taking their land away if they couldn't pay the taxes in order to make good on the debts owed to the wealthy. And the result was that in some states like Massachusetts, you had rebellions like Shays' Rebellion. And you had a number of Shays-like rebellions in many other states in the 1780s. But the fact of the matter is you didn't have Shays' Rebellion in a lot of other states. So the question is, why didn't Shays' Rebellion happen in all the states? And it seems to me the answer is because many state legislatures responded not to the needs of the creditors, but to the needs of the debtors. That many states began to print paper money. Many states passed what are called stay laws, which meant that basically you don't have to pay your debts this year because times are tough. And so many governments responded to the real needs of their own people. I would suggest that those were the states in which the creditors began to push for the need for a constitution.
Which would really explain a lot of Hamilton's fiscal policies.
Exactly.
In terms of his national finance issues. Yeah.
That ultimately, it would seem to me that it's the states that don't respond to the needs of the poor that produce the nationalists who see the need to scrap the articles. In other words, if government is coming under the control of the poor, and the poor are demanding that more paper money be printed and are passing laws requiring creditors to accept this worthless paper in payment of debts, and if states are passing laws that worthless paper money can be used to pay taxes, then in a sense, government is looking out for the wrong people. And they feel the only way to fix that is to take away the power of state governments to interfere with private contracts at all. And so ultimately what you have is a constitution where contracts, private contracts, are made sacrosanct. In other words, what you do is you create a government that the majority can't get hold of, Therefore, you make things like paper money and all those things illegal. No longer can states print paper money. No longer. And ultimately what you do is you ensure the best interest of the creditors by taking power of the way, away from the states to respond to the needs of the debtors. And ultimately that's what you begin to see in the 1780s. So you got to realize that the push for the Constitution and the push for scrapping the Articles was being made primarily by people who had an agenda. They had a vested interest of making the Articles of Confederation look bad. Because the worse the Articles looked, the more likely people were going to be to support a whole new form of government which took power away from the states to respond to the interests of the poor at all. So I would argue the first question, resolving differences of opinion in America over how best to handle natural differences of opinion between the rich and the poor in America, I would argue that that's a major theme of the whole period. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to
in the 1790s,
you get into get the Hamilton's yeah. program about this, about the new federal government assuming all the federal debts, assuming state debts, and passing protective tariffs and setting up a bank. Whose interests are being protected here? Whose interests? Hamilton's definition of growth and power in the American political system are best served by doing what? And his whole economic program is oriented towards the interests of the few, the bankers, the merchants, the investors, the speculators.
Well, I mean, even look at the restructuring program. Hamilton made sure that possible investors knew about the restructuring
right.
program so that they would
so
purchase
they
old bonds.
So that they could,
so they could speculate.
And ultimately what Hamilton is doing is buying the support of the wealthy interest in this country by making them directly dependent on government payoffs for securities.
Binding them to the federal government.
Binding them to the new federal government. In other words, you'll support whatever government is paying you. You know, basically, you support the government that sends you your checks. And that's why Hamilton wants to assume the state debts.
State debts, yes.
Because he doesn't want people to be paid by the states. He wants people's payments to come from the new federal government. So he seems to be doing a favor to the states by saying, forget about your Revolutionary War debts. The new federal government will take them all over and make good on all of them. We'll pay them for you. What he's doing is buying the loyalty of the creditors who hold these certificates to the new national government at the expense of the state governments. And the anti-federalists see this. I mean, the opponent, what become the Jeffersonians, that Madison and the rest of them, they see this.
Ironically, who had supported the Constitution. Madison really is a key opponent in both of those issues.
Right.
Both the restructuring and the state assumption.
The Madison of the 90s and the Madison of the 80s. Unbelievable
yeah.
difference. Mm-hmm. Madison wrote the Virginia Plan. And Madison leads the opposition, the creation of an opposition party in Congress in the 1790s against Hamilton and the Washington administration. He's the architect in Congress of what becomes the Jeffersonian Republican opposition party. He gets Jefferson elected president of the United States in 1800.
And part of that's sectional.
Yeah.
But only part of
He's
it.
He's a Virginian.
Mean, yeah, part of it's sectional. I mean, Virginia had paid their state debt.
Right.
Massachusetts had not.
Had not.
And so Virginia is being asked to pay twice.
Pay twice.
As far as Madison was concerned.
Right. And that's the very famous dinner in order to get the assumption of state debts.
Yeah.
Where Hamilton invites Jefferson to a dinner and basically makes a deal. If you can get your Virginia, your Southern supporters to support assumption of state debts, we will use our influence to make sure that the South gets the capital of the United States. Washington, D.C. is located on the Potomac as a result of this deal to get assumption through.
I can't remember the numbers in terms of the House vote. But it's interesting to look at House votes at that time because the numbers are so low.
Right,
because the House
right.
is so small.
Well, yeah.
But the shift in terms of votes, we don't know exactly what happened that evening, right?
Well, Jefferson, later in his life, Jefferson writes all these letters
right.
and said he was hoodwinked and everything else, that he didn't sell out.
Right.
Jefferson really does not want to leave this earth and have people believe that he really sold them out.
Of course, fortunately for him at that point, Hamilton's dead.
And he really did.
But that change in terms of the vote is very dramatic.
Oh, man, it's... And then you get to the question that you love about our standing among other nations. What kinds of changes had happened in the world, and how can we gain respect? Hamilton believes that a government that doesn't pay its debts doesn't get any respect. Right. And we had to build our credit with foreign overseas creditors. And now we're debating in this country right now about raising the debt ceiling and about worrying about whether what happens if China and Japan all of a sudden begin to demand payment of the debt they hold of ours. What will happen to us and how much debt can we carry in this country and all the rest of it? And are we jeopardizing our standing and our power in the world? And that's what Hamilton believed, that a nation that pays its debts is a nation that is respected right. in the world.
Even if you look at his bank plan, the Bank of the United States, as Hamilton envisions it, is modeled after the Bank of England. And so Hamilton, in many ways, saw England as the model. You really see a key difference, I think. Of course, you see that constitutional difference and the way they present that to Washington, both Hamilton and Jefferson, in terms of broad and strict construction, but also in terms of the foreign policy issue. The French Revolution obviously is major here because the United States is not operating in a vacuum, and the United States is technically tied to Europe because right. of that Franco-American alliance.
The Franco Treaty of 1778. Right.
And so when the revolution begins, as the revolution proceeds and it's clear that France is going to be at war with Austria and Prussia and right. eventually Britain, the fear is always going to be the United States is going to be dragged into that.
Dragged in.
There's a difference of opinion on the nature of the French Revolution between Hamilton and Jefferson.
Right.
And as that revolution changes.
And Jefferson yeah. sees the French Revolution as the playing out of, yeah. the emergence of Republican government around the world. Mm-hmm. And he's almost forced to explain away the excesses
right.
of the French Revolution, and the other thing is when you get into the Jefferson administration, Jefferson's whole approach to foreign mm-hmm. policy, and the idea
Embargo Act.
The idea that we don't yeah. want Jefferson right. doesn't want cities, he doesn't want manufacturing.
Right.
You know, I find this fascinating because when they were colonies, if you remember, what England's Navigation Acts made it illegal for the colonies to do was manufacture. They wanted all the manufacturing to be in England. So the colonies were seen as sources of raw materials. The colonies were supposed to ship the raw materials to the mother country. The mother country got the jobs in the factories, yeah. turning raw materials into manufactured goods, and then selling them back to the New World. So the colonies were seen as colonies, as sources of raw materials for the mother country and for the empire. And the implication was if the empire prospered, all the parts of it prospered as well. It's kind of like, I mean, we're talking tonight from West Virginia.
Right.
West Virginia is a colonial economy. And what that means is our wealth is in raw materials. It's in coal. It's in
natural
shale.
Gas, timber.
It's in shale and timber and all of those things. And so the implications, the reality is, that most of our wealth is owned by people outside West Virginia. So most of the wealth is not ours. We have to pay for our own coal on the world market, on the national market. It's not like we could mine our own coal and take care of our own needs first. So when they say that coal keeps the lights on, that's the way maybe it ought to be. But the reality is the coal is owned by companies outside the state. So the coal is mined and export it out of West Virginia. And then ultimately we're forced to pay the price that everybody else pay for our own coal. And so in reality, we don't really gain the advantages that we could get if we manufactured, if we processed our own coal. And so as colonies, England would not allow the colonies to manufacture. Hamilton realizes in his plan, in his economic plan, that as long as the United States, the new nation, must depend on England and other nations of Europe for manufactured goods, will always be dependent, will always be weak.
Thus his tariff policy.
Right. Yeah. His tariff policy and his policy on manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Hamilton's argument is what we have got to do is pump money into our manufacturing establishment so we're able to supply our own manufactured needs and we don't have to depend on anybody. Jefferson sees that as a negative. He sees that with manufacturing comes cities, and with cities comes overpopulation and unemployment and stench and filth and crime and immorality and alcoholism mm-hmm. and all the negative things that Europe is so known for. Jefferson believes, this is one reason he wants Louisiana. Jefferson believes that if we have enough opportunity for this nation to remain a nation of farmers, farmers are reputable people. I mean, Jefferson, it's just, oh, it's just wonderful. I just love this. Jefferson believes that there's something about farming, about people who get dirt under their fingernails, who dig in the dirt and create life in terms of vegetables and plants and flowers and all of this. He believes that there's something ennobling to the human spirit about people who actually dig in the dirt and produce life. And Jefferson believes that people who live their life that way are noble, God-fearing, virtuous people. And he wants a nation of farmers, a nation of rural people, all of them owning their own land. And he wants to avoid large urban neighborhoods of unemployed people and mobs and riots and ethnic neighborhoods and garbage and filth and all of the things that are associated with the worst evils of the cities of Europe. And so Jefferson believes that even though we don't manufacture, even though we have to buy our manufacturing from other places, Jefferson believes that if we can maintain our status as the top producer of agriculture and raw materials in the world, the nations that do manufacture will be so dependent on us for their raw materials that we will have power. We will have leverage. They will have to listen to us because they'll all be dependent on us for our raw materials and our agricultural goods. So Jefferson believed that we can use our agricultural potential as a diplomatic weapon to earn credibility and prestige among the world of nations. Hamilton believes that the only nations that have power are the nations that can supply all of their own needs independently. His belief is the more dependent you are, the weaker you are. And so you have these two competing beliefs as to how best you earn the respect and the credibility of other nations and establish your place among the world of nations. They both want the same thing.
Yeah.
They just disagree on
how to obtain it. And their models are different. If Hamilton is, in a sense, wanting to emulate Britain, Jefferson is wanting to emulate France. The French economy is still largely agrarian in the 18th century. And so that's certainly still the case.
Right.
The physiocrats talked about agriculture being the source of all wealth.
So Jefferson is naturally drawn to the French because he spent all that time there.
Right.
But Jefferson is drawn naturally to the French. Hamilton's drawn naturally to
the
British, to the manufacturing versus the agriculture. And, of course, in the United States, Hamilton's program clearly benefit the middle and the northern states, the northeastern states. Mm-hmm. Jefferson's agricultural priorities benefit the south and the west.
Right.
So ultimately, the
sectionalism
that exists in the nation between agriculture and manufacturing, between north and south, between urban and rural, is played out in the differences between Hamilton and Jefferson, between the differences between the Federalists and the Jeffersonians in terms of what the proper role for government ought to be.
Right. All in a world that is erupting in war as a result of the French Revolution. And once they kill the king in January 1793, that revolution becomes very radical, and that means that Europe is going to be inflamed in a general conflict, and that flows into the Napoleonic Wars as well. The United States always had the potential to get drawn into that.
Right.
And the question is how to stay out of it. Hamilton believes he needs to stay out of it.
Right. And Washington, of course, with his neutrality proclamation, is that we need to stay neutral. And then when Washington leaves office in 96, in his very famous farewell address, he warns the nation about entangling alliances, the French alliance of 1778, entangling alliances that draw us into situations where we have no business being. And he warns the nation against for foreign policy, the idea that we need to remain neutral, we need to maintain our flexibility in international affairs. Mm-hmm. So I can see why you think Part C.
Well, that's exciting.
That's where you want to go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
in terms
just
of the international role. Yeah.
And then the other one we have is the debate between, what makes the most sense in terms of the proper relationship that should exist in America between rights and powers that are rightfully reserved to the states and rights and powers which are better carried out on the national level.
Okay.
And, of course, then you get to the question of states' rights versus national power, the power of the new government under the Constitution versus the power that theoretically are retained in the states with the Tenth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, right, which is all powers not granted, to the reserved to the states. And so the implication is how much, and then you get into the issue of the very nature of the union itself, mm-hmm, as to whether there's more power on the national level or whether the power's on the state level or whether it really is shared between the two. And Jefferson and Madison are the architects in the 90s of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, yes, which argue for states' rights,
yeah,
against the Constitution that Madison wrote.
But the context the being the Alien and Sedition Acts,
right,
and the Quasi-War.
Right.
Yeah.
And what they're seeing is the abuses of national power that are taking place under Hamilton and the Hamiltonian, mm-hmm, Federalists. And so in looking for a constitutional way out, states' rights seems to be the way, the right to nullify.
Nullification.
And ultimately this becomes, of course, the same strategy that
Calhoun, is the germ, yeah, of secession.
That ultimately becomes outright secession in the 19th century.
Right. They look back to that.
And so you have this debate over federalism, about where power is and where it ought to be, and the role of the courts and all the rest of it, and all the compromises that were reached during the Constitutional Convention on the differences between North and South and the differences between national power and state power.
I tell you, I've always found it very interesting in terms of the Adams administration, that in essence you see factionalism even within a faction, because Adams himself is really at odds with Hamilton,
yeah,
in so many ways,
yeah,
without doubt, over foreign policy, yeah, obviously, in terms of how we should deal with French seizure of American ships, but you see that Adams himself has to deal with that, and so even within a party or a faction you can have profound differences.
Keith, the last choice here,
okay,
is kind of pick your own. I mean, basically, this,
right,
this is one of those, remember the old famous thing of make up your own question,
yeah,
and then answer it? Basically, what I'm saying is select the issue or the question that you feel during this period best makes the case for the transition that occurred between the optimism of the founders in 1776 and the realities of what America's life in 1815.
We have a question here. Yeah, you want to answer the question first?
Answer the question.
Okay, this question is from Jim. And Jim asks, how strictly did our mother country attempt to enforce the respective taxes designed to help pay for protection afforded before the French and Indian War? To what degree were they enforced is his question. Things such as the Navigation Acts, to what degree were they enforced before the French and Indian War? It's a good question.
It is a good question,
yeah,
because one of England's real problems always was the issue of enforcement. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, England had operated under what many people refer to, the scholars refer to as salutary neglect. And the idea that the best way to handle this is not to handle it at all. And the colonies almost become used to self-rule during the colonial period, during the 18th century, because England really is unable to find an effective way to enforce its navigation policies, its, mm-hmm, regulatory policies regulating the colonies. So it's not until the French, the costs of the French Revolution, that England begins to really
implement
ways to actually enforce these things. That's when they become painful.
In fact, I believe that Pitt the Elder, who George III's prime minister, found that the customs system cost more than it was bringing in.
Right.
And so even really before the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, the same war, even before it was over with, they started to come up with, new efforts to enforce old measures, such as the use of writs of assistance,
right,
and things of that are trying to really kind of enforce those, yeah, old measures in a new way. I tell you, a good book that I could refer Jim to on this issue would be Fred Anderson, Crucible of War,
mm-hmm,
which is about the Seven Years' War and about British policy, especially the latter part of the book, about British policy in the wake of the French and Indian War. And it was clear which way that thing was going by 1760.
Again, I refer in our class to Fisk's book on the critical period.
Yeah.
If you remember, his first chapter is about British politics during this period and the fact that Great Britain really didn't know what the hell they were doing,
right,
very honestly. I mean, they really didn't know how to run an empire from that far away. They knew that they had the right to make all decisions, but in practical terms, there was no way they could make all day-to-day,
yeah,
decisions. And the result is many of them were made locally. But the fact of the matter is, and Jim, nothing's ever as clear as it seems. At least it seems that way. And the fact of the matter is, those leading the movement for independence, the Sam Adamses and the James Otises and all of these people in the colonial period, are doing the best they can to paint England's colonial officials as almost yes men of decisions that are being made in England. They blame it all on Parliament. They blame it all on the King. When in the fact of the matter is, none of it really is happening. Most of the decisions are being made locally, and it's the royal governors of Great Britain that are sending the word back to the mother country and are saying, you guys don't have any idea what's happening over here. If you knew, Hutchinson, Governor Hutchinson of Massachusetts, is sending word over to the mother country all the time. For God's sake, you're playing right into the hands of these radicals. And that's what England does. In other words, on paper, it has the power to enforce, but in practical terms, it doesn't. And when it tries to turn paper into reality, by that time, the colonists have been ruling themselves for so long that they feel that Parliament is making unconstitutional infringements in taxation without representation in Parliament and all the rest of it.
But, Jim, your question certainly has something in there that's very important. You mentioned the French and Indian War, and that is crucial. In 1760 is a crucial year with the death of King George II, the ascension of King George III to the throne. George III came to the throne wanting, of course, the books balanced, whereas Pitt had been intent upon spending everything in order to beat the French.
Yeah.
And so they were very lavish in terms of how much they spent in terms of that war. And that is a global conflict.
Yeah, how much debt how much
debt incurred, right? Yeah. You know, I'm going to beat France. Somewhat like Churchill,
right,
you know, was in the 20th century in terms of how he was determined they were going to beat Hitler no matter what. And so that really kind of represents Pitt's tenacity as well. And so that is a crucial event, the French and Indian War, and especially in terms of that change in 1760, because you certainly have, from the top coming down, a real emphasis on balancing the books.
You know, the irony of the situation is that there were the colonies had real friends in Parliament, and many of them, Edmund Burke Wilkes and the others. And their argument is basically the best thing to do with the colonies is nothing. We've got, right now, we're running the world. I mean, we're getting the best of all possible worlds right now. Why basically throw a monkey wrench in by trying to do anything different? Maybe they are smuggling. Maybe they're not abiding by the rules. But the fact of the matter is, England is getting most of what the colonies produce. All we're going to do is create trouble for ourselves if we interfere with that. In other words, we've got a system that works. For God's sake, let's not mess around and screw it up. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they did.
Exactly.
So,
good question, though, Jim.
I want to recommend, you recommended this book.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's monumental. I use the word monumental in the assignment in this question. But the fact of the matter is, every chapter has information that is so valuable and so rich, and the source materials, the footnotes, you can go now with Rotunda and all the thing, you can go to the sources that have all the letters, and I mean, you find the letters, the appropriate letters and all the rest of it here, you can go and get the originals in the primary sources. But in reading, I just wanted to share with you, I find this so fascinating, and this to me was one of the most eye-opening experiences. I read Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, which he first wrote in 1785. And he talks, you know, most people see it as the first real evidence that Jefferson was the Renaissance man. I mean, he's got things in there on plants and animals and climate and rainfall and mountains and rivers. And I mean, he just seems to know so much about so many different things. And it's all played out in Jefferson's Notes on Virginia. But what Gordon Wood points out in this book, and I'll give you the specific references to where in a moment, is that some of the best parts of Jefferson are the editors have taken right out of that book, right out of the Notes on Virginia. I read the Notes on Virginia. I didn't even know that this stuff existed. In the chapter on the Jeffersonian West, which I believe is chapter 10 in Gordon Wood's book. Let me be. I guess I could look at the table of contents here instead of thumbing through page.
Chapter 10,
the Jeffersonian West. If you go toward the end of the chapter, the last 15 pages or so of the chapter, beginning on page 385, Gordon Wood deals with Europe's effort to try to explain the nature of North America, the New World. And Jefferson is among those that's talking about, and Franklin and all the rest of them, are talking about the freedom in the West and the opportunity in all of this and how people are going to emigrate from Europe, from all over the world to come to the New World. And Jefferson sees the West as being the source of all this opportunity. His desire to buy Louisiana, to get East Florida and West Florida and all the rest of it.
Which is not strict construction in action at all.
It's nothing to do. I mean, he basically said when Hamilton wanted to create a bank that the federal government didn't have the power under the Constitution to do that. But when Hamilton pointed out that the Constitution didn't give him the power to buy his Louisiana, he basically was able to rationalize. I mean, basically he said, the hell with it. I want it. We're going to get it. And so Jefferson takes every opportunity to expand the confines of the United States that he can. He has visions for Canada. He has visions for Cuba. It's just unbelievable. And basically what he sees is providing land, which in his view was opportunity, which allows American opportunity to expand. He sees freedom expanding with the expanding across the continent itself. And so Wood's title, Empire of Liberty, Jefferson uses this over and over and over. Every time he sees the opportunity to expand the confines of this nation, he talks about basically what we are doing is creating an empire of liberty. We are creating more opportunity for more people to be free, which means to own land and have a future and be able to experience the realities of farming and becoming one of God's chosen people.
And with the Northwest Ordinance, the assumption being that everywhere we expand will eventually become part of the polity.
Exactly. And the point I'm trying to make is in Europe, Europeans are painting the New World in totally different colors than is Jefferson and than are the founders. And beginning on page 385, Wood begins to talk about the writings of the Comte de Buffon, who is a naturalist, who writes a 36-volume natural history published between 1749 and 1800 in France. He is the naturalist advisor to Louis XVI in France. And Buffon begins to paint a picture of North America which is totally different and alien. And I'm just going to read some of this because I can't resist it. Buffon says the American continents are newer than those of the old world. They had, it seems, only recently emerged from the flood, and they hadn't properly dried out yet. So the result was that the American air was more humid than that of the older continents. The topography was more irregular. There were more mountains. The weather was more variable. The forests and swamps were more extensive. In short, Buffon said, America is an unhealthy climate in which people could live. Animals in the New World, Buffon says, are underdeveloped, even the animals, smaller than the animals of the old world. Americans didn't have any lions, for example. Buffon says they had something called the American puma, which was scarcely a real lion, because a real lion has a mane. These lions didn't even have manes. That ultimately, the New World produced, quote, much smaller, weaker, and more cowardly lions than real lions. Jefferson goes out of his mind.
How many lions are in France at this particular time?
And if they're talking about African elephants and the North American continent doesn't have all the disease.
Of course, if I was advising the king whose predecessor had lost North America, American colonies, I might have said something similar.
I'm just thinking to myself, as a teacher of history, how can you not get kids excited? I mean, this is fantastic. And this is the stuff that's not even, the editors take this out of the Notes on Virginia because the assumption is nobody will read it or understand it or whatever. Buffon's conclusion about the environment in the New World was stark and frightening, especially to Jefferson. Living nature, he wrote, is thus much less active there, much less varied, and we may even say less strong. To learn that the peculiar American habitat had affected animal life was unsettling, but to learn that the environment of the New World was also unhealthy for human beings was truly alarming. Jefferson went out of his mind over this stuff. Buffon claimed that the American environment was responsible for the apparently retarded development of native Indians, who seemed to be wandering savages stuck in the first stages of social development without any structured society. The Indians, Buffon said, were like reptiles. They're cold-blooded. Their organs of generation are smaller and more feeble, he says. The natives of the New World have no hair, no beards, no ardor for the females. They don't produce as many children. Their social bonds are weak. They have very few children and pay little attention to those that they do have. In some ways, the moist climate of the New World had devastatingly affected the physical and social character of the only human beings native to it. The outlook of humans in the Old World was transplanted to this forbidding environment and was therefore not a happy one. Whereas most Americans looked at the idea of the movement west as the expansion of civilization from the east to the west, Buffon and the other Europeans are telling Jefferson and Franklin and the rest of them that what is civilization on the east coast becomes savagery the further west it moves. And so his argument is that as civilized people go to the New World, they become less and less civilized. They become more and more like the savages. And they pick up every story of white people scalping Indians and white savages as classic example that the New World environment makes savages out of civilized people rather than provides opportunity for more and more civilization. Jefferson has to counter that. And so Jefferson's whole notes on Virginia, Jefferson's whole idea behind commissioning Lewis and Clark to travel through the Northwest after the Louisiana Purchase and record every fauna and every flora and every plant and every flower and every animal is his effort to naturally document the fact that this environment was not inferior but superior. And ultimately, he is as much in the notes on Virginia committing exactly the same thing that Pericles did in his funeral oration in Athens, in ancient Athens. He is basically out to prove Europeans wrong and out to demonstrate that American civilization, that Western, the New World, is going to allow the greatest civilization in the history of mankind to flourish. That's why, this is what fascinates me. That's why Jefferson goes out of his mind. He's absolutely paranoid about the Indians. Because the Indians, to him, provide the opportunity to prove that moving from savagery to civilization is possible in this society. He's not nearly as concerned about blacks. Because blacks aren't native to here. Blacks come from Africa. And his argument is that as American civilization develops in the New World, so also will the Indian become more and more civilized. The Indian will become more and more white. This is fascinating to me. Madison's cousin is the president of William and Mary, and he sends a letter to Jefferson and says, we have an Indian in the student body at William and Mary. And the 2 years that Indian has been here as a student, he's turning white. His skin is actually becoming lighter. And he is able to convince Jefferson that this civilization is going to whiten Indians and it's going to whiten blacks. Jefferson is actually pointing to the South when white slave masters mix with black slaves, with female slaves, and produced mixed-race children as an indication that exposure to our civilization makes blacks whiter Indians whiter, and the whole civilization is becoming more civilized and more advanced in opposition to everything that the naturalists in Europe are saying. It is absolutely unbelievable. So for Jefferson, he has got to civilize the Indians. He's got to break up, he's got to take their land, he's got to break up the tribes, and he has to basically turn Indians into independent farmers, which to him will produce the ideal God-fearing citizen that a republic ought to have. So more than anything else, Jefferson is responsible for the movement that Jackson picks up and moves the Indians off their land with the Trail of Tears later on in the 19th century. Jefferson, for the best of motives, and if you read the guy, it's just fascinating what he wants to do. It absolutely is unbelievable. And his notes on Virginia and all of it. I mean, you can see how absolutely determined Americans are during this period to prove that everything the world thinks about us is not only not right, but in fact exactly the opposite. We will prove to the world that we are better, stronger, our animals are bigger, our males are more masculine, our people produce more testosterone, our women have more children, our economies grow faster, our people are richer, our forests are more beautiful, our natural resources are greater, and on and on and on. Our power is greater. In other words, everything we see in American civilization today about how much better than everybody else we have to be is in these 15 pages in Jefferson's effort to try to prove Comte de Profond and the other naturalists in Europe wrong. It is absolutely a mind-blowing. It is unbelievable. And it's so unbelievably pathetic and so prophetic, because it predicts the future of this nation. American exceptionalism, the belief that we have a special mission, that we're on a special mission to reform the world. If you remember, Jefferson was a product of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment and the period of John Locke. John Locke's essay on human understanding argued that man was a product of his environment. These people believed that everything man became, everything that civilization could become, was a product of the environment. So it was absolutely critical for Jefferson to prove that the environment of the New World allowed civilization to prosper. He had to counter the arguments of Europeans that actually the New World was taking civilized people and turning them into savages. Jefferson had to prove just the opposite. What we had to do is find a way to celebrate the movement west and the values of what American frontiersmen were about. Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis, and the frontiers responsible for American independence and American willingness to take on the absolutely unbelievable odds and to conquer the West and conquer the wilderness and all the things that become part of the American culture. All of these things are direct products of efforts to try to prove that Europeans are wrong about what the future of this nation is. This, to me...
So, to some degree, you would attribute even Manifest Destiny to Jefferson.
To this. Yeah. And Jefferson admitted that, I mean, one of the best quotes in this whole thing is Jefferson admitting that we have more rainfall than Europe does, but here it falls in half the time, he says. The rain falls in half the time. And he's talking about the fact that we do deal with excessive humidity in this country. He admits that. He looks, after the purchase of Louisiana, he looks at New Orleans. I think with Katrina, I see this. It's unbelievable. He looks at New Orleans, and he sees New Orleans as potentially the greatest city on the face of the earth, because all the wealth of the middle of the continent is going to come down the Mississippi River to New Orleans. New Orleans has the potential to be the commercial center of the world. But what he worries about is the humidity and the climate that New Orleans is in. Basically, he's really worried about that. He's worried about the extreme temperatures in the New World. That's one of the reasons he's opposed to cities, because in cities you have large numbers of unemployed people. You have people living in unhealthy conditions. You have garbage that's not properly disposed of. So you have heat and maggots and filth and disease and all of these things that are associated with cities. To Jefferson, we want none of that. That's why we have to keep expanding. We have to create opportunities for people to remain rural and live on farms and grow their own food and do all the things that God intended civilized man to do. And he sees the Indians as the epitome of this. He has got to convert the Indians from alternative cultures and tribes to basically that fit in naturally into the American free enterprise culture. And in the process, he undertakes policies that become the end, if you will, of the Native American experience and the Native American culture in America. It is one of the most absolutely astounding exchanges that I've ever seen. He talks about the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia as proof positive as to why cities are dangerous. And one of the things I wanted to quote is this on page 397 of Gordon Wood's book. Jefferson never questioned that the Indians might not want to become civilized and to participate in the progressive course of history as he saw it. In his mind, and in the minds of most enlightened Americans, his intentions are pure. And this is what Jefferson says to the Indians. He told a delegation of Northwestern Indians in 1809, just before he left the presidency, "We will never do an unjust act towards you," he said. "On the contrary, we wish you to live in peace, to increase in numbers, to learn to labor as we do, and furnish food for your ever-increasing numbers. When the game shall have left you, we wish to see you possessed of property and protecting it by regular laws. In time, you will be as we are. You will become one people with us. Your blood will mix with ours and will spread with ours over this great land," unquote, says Jefferson. What Jefferson did to the Indians ultimately is one of the great shames, it seems to me, of our civilization. But what you get here is the realization that he did this for the most noble and purest of reasons. It was unbelievable how his mind worked and how you understand the period and the thinking of the Enlightenment, that it was the environment that created everything. Man had no control over himself. His environment controlled everything that man became. And so ultimately, by exposing Native Americans to this New World environment, Jefferson believed that we could produce nothing else but citizens who would totally fit into the American cultural experience. If you're talking about an example of a change in attitude and how it affects the future, this is it. And this book is just rich with stuff like this that none of us as history teachers have ever come with. This is all the stuff that the textbooks skip. Most of us have never had this stuff. And when you read it and you read these letters, you can't help but develop an empathy and a respect and a sense of understanding for these people that is infectious. Your students will get it as well. Keith, we're almost.
I think we're close. Would you define this, or would you contend that the reason why textbooks tend to leave this aspect out, especially in dealing with Jefferson, is because it's paternalism?
It's paternalism, yeah. and it deals with race. And we made a decision in this country that we would never talk about race or religion, and so we don't. And the reality is the founders did.
Jefferson talked about both.
He talked about both all the time.
Right, yeah.
The piece that I mentioned earlier, and I'll just mention this before we close, the book notes piece that I mentioned last night that will be on Blackboard is an interview on the book Inventing George Washington. And it talks about the efforts of American leaders during the early 19th century to invent the Washington they wanted rather than to deal with the Washington they really had. I mean, there's no reason to enhance the reputation of Washington given what history teaches us. But the fact of the matter is that we did create a Washington that we wanted our young people to respect. The cherry tree story is the most significant example. But what this book, Inventing George Washington, does is deal with all the myths as well as the realities of George Washington. one of the things that they talk about in this interview is the idea, and they quote, they mentioned both Glenn Beck and they mentioned Sean Hannity as talking about a quote, a statement that George Washington made about the need for the Bible and the need for God in order to govern a nation. And they both point out that from their research, nowhere in the writings or the speeches of George Washington can they ever find where he said that. And ultimately, the author of Inventing George Washington, his position is that this is part, this is the latest example of turning George Washington into something that particular people in a society want him to become. In this case, they wanted to make George Washington into an evangelical Christian. And what this man points out, and I would look at the interview. It's on your Blackboard situation. And just Google, just go on the internet and Google afterwards, and you'll see the interview on with the author of Inventing George Washington. What he points out is that Washington left this earth when he retired from the presidency in 1796 and died in 1799. He wanted to be the force that brought the differences in this nation together. And their feeling is that part of the reason that Washington didn't say more about his religious views was because the more he said, the less of a uniting figure he would become. And he had made the choice late in life that the most important role that he could play for this nation was to be the force that brought people together. And the only way to do that was to not emphasize the things which would cause people to split rather than to unite. That's their conclusion, and both of them agreed on the interview that I watched last evening that this probably makes the most sense the more you understand George Washington. It's fascinating stuff. This stuff is, you can't tell me that you can't get kids interested in history when you present stuff like this. Keith, anything else? Are we done? Again, please let me tell our teachers one more time. Please get all of your essays in by the 10th, which is a Tuesday, 10th of May. I will have your final grades posted by the 13th of May. You will be getting emails from me starting immediately. As I grade your essays, I'll be sending you evaluations of your essays and grades individually via email over the next week to 10 days.
And we certainly look forward to seeing everybody at the Academy.
Oh, hey, listen, all you teachers, come, please. Our Academy begins on June 29th. It's a Wednesday. And for those of you who are not involved in PRISM, Bob Kincaid, God love him, is going to make all of this programming available live on the Internet. You'll be able to get it all. John Kaminsky, Bob Bliss, Stanley Cutler, all of it. It's going to be great. Thank you all for being with us this evening. Thanks again for your love of history. Thank you.